You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
In the 1920s, the hills of northeast Oklahoma were soaked in oil and blood, though the oil deposits found in the area had made the Osage Native Americans who owned the land rich, tribe members soon began to die at an alarming rate, and they often died in shocking and violent ways. One by one, tribe members turned up stabbed, shot, beaten, or bombed. Some two dozen of them died mysteriously throughout the 1920s, their deaths spreading terror throughout the Osage Hills. There was clearly something rotten in Oklahoma, but what exactly was going on? The so-called Osage Indian Murders, recently featured in the 2023 Martin Scorsese film Killers of the Flower Moon, initially stumped investigators. At least, those who lived long enough to be stumped. The first white lawman who attempted to solve the murders ended up dead as well, one brutally stabbed, the other thrown from a moving train. Meanwhile, the murders continued. In the winter of 1923, one man was shot in the head. A few months later, several members of an Osage family were killed when their house was bombed. The terrified community tried to protect itself by keeping their homes illuminated at night and prohibiting their children from going anywhere alone. But it seemed that anyone with Osage blood and rights to the oil bubbling beneath their feet was in grave danger. Finally, the federal government was prompted to investigate what newspapers had started calling the bloodiest chapter in American crime history. J. Edgar Hoover of the newly created Bureau of Investigation, which would later become the FBI, sent an experienced lawman named Tom White to check things out. White, a former Texas Ranger, put together a cadre of men to go undercover in Oklahoma and find out why so many Osage were dying. He and the others would soon uncover the shocking truth. The Osage Indian murders, so seemingly random, so stunningly violent, had been orchestrated by a single man, motivated by greed and willing to go to great lengths to satiate his desire for the Osage tribe's oil-rich lands. He put together a devious plot to slowly drain the tribe of their oil ownership. He was so determined to get his hands on the tribe's riches, in fact, that he had no qualms about using members of his own family to do his dirty work. This is the story of the Osage Indian Murders and Killers of the Flower Moon. You're listening to History Uncovered, brought to you by the digital publisher All That's Interesting, where we explore the uncharted corners of the natural world and the world past. I'm All That's Interesting staff writer Kalina Fraga.
And I'm All That's Interesting staff writer Austin Harvey.
Today, we're unpacking the true story of the Osage Indian Murders. All right, so let's go back more than a century, I guess, back to the 19th century. Yeah, so we're going to start with the Osage tribe themselves. Like a lot of other Native American tribes in the 19th century, they were driven out of their native land, which was Kansas, and they moved into Oklahoma, where they purchased this sort of like rocky land in the 1870s. But they had this idea that the land probably had oil in it. So they were really careful that when they signed the Osage Allotment Act in 1906, that they would have control of any subsurface minerals. And then oil's discovered and they're in control of it, which is a pretty big deal.
Interesting. This feels really late in the timeline of American history to be like pushing Native tribes out of their homes. That feels like a 17th, 18th century thing.
Oh, no. Well, because the Transcontinental Railroad is finished in the 1860s, and that suddenly makes it a lot easier for settlers to move west.
Makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so there's like, I think there's a lot of stages of that happening, and This was like a pretty big one.
I guess that was around the time of the Civil War, so I shouldn't be like, what? White people were doing bad things?
Yeah, right. It's right after the Civil War ends, the railroads are connected.
Yeah, fair enough.
They discovered oils, a lot of wealth for the tribe. Members who owned land got something called a headright, which were hereditary, which means that they could only pass to the owner's legal heir, which means they couldn't be bought or sold. You couldn't like come into the tribe and like buy it from someone.
Right. Had to be inherited.
It had to be inherited. And these were really, really lucrative. They could be as much as $13,000 a year, which in today's money would be over $200,000
wow.
a year per person.
That's nice. Pre-tax?
I probably.
Nah, it doesn't matter.
A family of four would have like almost $1 million a year.
Wow.
In other words, that's a lot of money. The American public was fascinated by this. The media called them red millionaires, which is a pretty racist term.
Yeah, of
course.
A
lot of that around in Oklahoma at the time. But the American government also came in and put down some restrictions on the tribe. They said that the head right owners had to have white guardians who managed their assets and supervised how they spent their money. And unsurprisingly, this meant a lot of people were shortchanged. An Osage veteran said, "I fought in France for this country, and yet I am not allowed to even sign my own checks."
Jeez. And that was a World War One veteran. So this
World War
is
I
like
veteran,
years have passed now.
Yeah, it's like 50 years since they got this land and everything. Still, there's about 2,000 tribal members who are very wealthy. They can afford these big houses. And they can even afford to hire white servants. Then in the 1920s, they start to die very mysterious and violent deaths.
And as the title of the episode would tell you, it was murder. It was foul play.
And it was murder. Yeah, it's murder.
Yeah, there wasn't like a disease outbreak. They were
well. It was a little hard to tell at first. Like the one of the first deaths was attributed to a wasting illness in 1918. But now they think it might have been
illness?
Poisoning. Yeah,
which is like,
you know, it's 1918. It's like
oh, well, he just wasted away. It seems.
You know, it's funny. I think I mentioned this last time, but there was this woman serial killer who killed her husband with Windex. And that's like how he just sort of wasted away. No one was sure.
Oh, yeah. Did they like slowly poisoned him, right? Like over time.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they wasted away.
Fair enough.
Anyway, these murders started happening in the 1920s. And this is kind of where we'll start bringing in the film a bit. But they seem to center around one woman whose name is Molly Kyle, who's played by Lily Gladstone in the movie. She's married to a white man named Ernest Burkhart, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. In 1921, in May, her sister Anna Brown is shot in the back of the head and dumped in a ravine. A few weeks later, Brown's cousin Charles Whitehorn is also shot and killed. And then in July, her mother, Lizzie Q. Kyle, was also killed in a likely poisoning. So people around her are sort of dropping out.
Wow.
And it becomes a lot of people. It's 2 dozen people by the end, at least. So the tribe doesn't know what to do. They know something's happening. They reach out for help to this white oilman named Barney McBride. He's a friend of the tribe, and they trust him. And he says he'll go to D.C. and ask the federal government for help in August 1922. But... He gets there.
Sorry, I think as you were saying that, my eyes drifted to the next bullet point. And I was like, oh.
Yeah. On August 10th, he's discovered dead, naked, his head smashed in, stabbed 20 times. He's been abducted from where he was staying at a boarding house in D.C. and found in Maryland.
Wow.
And this is blatant enough that the media starts to realize that something's going on.
Yeah, this goes all the way to the top.
Yeah. They describe McBride's death as the most brutal crime in the crime annals of the district.
Wow.
And now they're starting to be like, well, okay, these Native Americans have all this money and these head rights, and now they're all dying. And now this white man has died trying to get them help. Like,
oh, no, the white man's died. Now we care.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, no, it's sad and it's brutal, but like, yeah, come on, guys.
That's when they start. Yeah. Meanwhile, these murders continue to happen. In January 1923, Lizzie Q. Kyle's nephew is murdered. A few months later, someone bombs the home of Lizzie's daughter, Rita Smith, and she's killed alongside her husband, William E. Smith, and one of their servants. And as he's pulled from the rubble, he eventually dies. He says, "They got Rita, and it looks like they got me."
Wow.
So people know this is going on. Like, they know they're being targeted.
Jeez.
But no one can stop it. So then the second white man comes and tries to help the tribe. His name is W.W. Vaughn. He's an attorney. He interviews an Osage man who's dying of a suspected poisoning. He collects evidence. He starts to believe that he knows who the killers might be. Then in June, he disappears en route to Osage County. His body is found stripped, naked, neck broken. He's apparently thrown from his train.
Wow.
And all the evidence that he gathered about the case is gone.
Why are we stripping these guys naked? Is that relevant?
I don't know. It's probably retribution or...
Yeah. Or just like a...
Something.
Like intimidation tactic.
Yeah.
There's something like more unsettling
like
about a guy being
DNA
found...
DNA or something, you know?
That's what I mean. Like, it seems like an extra weird step, but...
Yeah. So now by this point, at least 24 Osage tribal members had been murdered. A lot of people had just fled to California.
How many members were in the tribe at the time, do you know?
Well, 2,000 had these head rights.
Oh, okay.
I believe. Yeah. So it's just a lot of people to die anyway, anywhere. So in 1925, the Bureau of Investigations, which is the precursor to the FBI, sends an investigative team to Oklahoma. So the leader of this team is this guy named Tom White. He's a former Texas Ranger, and he puts together a team of frontier lawmen to go undercover, including a Native American man named John Wren, who was probably the only Native American in the BOI, as they called it. They pose as a cattle buyer, an insurance salesman, a medicine man, and an oil prospector, and live among the Osage to gain their trust and investigate possible suspects.
Huh.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting.
They quickly start to realize that these white guardians managing the headrights are stealing from the tribal members. Not a surprise.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't really need a whole undercover investigation to tell you that
I think the Osage knew that was happening already. They also start to realize that something much worse is going on.
It goes all the way to the top.
Yeah. Well, they start to follow the money and they realize that all these or many of the dead tribal members have some kind of connection to Molly Kyle, and headrights belonging to Anna, Rita, and Lizzie had passed on to Molly and her husband, Ernest. And at this point, these headrights are worth $500,000 a year. So it's very lucrative.
Right.
Ernest happens to be someone considered to be weak-willed and the nephew of a powerful local man named William King Hale, who's played by Robert De Niro in the movie, who calls himself the King of the Osage Hills.
Hmm.
So a guy with a pretty healthy ego.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's really not hard to trace this line of, like, you know what I mean? It's all these people die. They're all connected to this one woman, like, familially. She's married to a white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then his uncle is literally going, I'm the King of the Osage Hills. And it's like,
yeah, but he wasn't like he was a powerful figure, but he also acted like their friend. Like I believe he learned their language, and like it seemed like he was supporting them and was an ally towards them.
Sure, sure.
But he wasn't.
I'm curious if in the movie, if they portray him as a more like charitable figure early on. I'll have to report back next week.
You will have to, yeah.
But I'm curious to see, because it's like, as we're going through this story, it's like very obvious what's going on now. I've granted, with the benefit of 100 years of history,
right,
in hindsight and whatnot. But like, yeah, it's obviously the wealthy white guy.
I do believe that the Osage had like suspected that he had something to do with it.
Yeah.
But they were sort of powerless and no one was helping them. People who were trying to help them kept getting killed themselves.
Yeah, fair enough.
So yeah, so he acted like their friend, but in fact had been kind of orchestrating all these murders to collect the profits from the headrights, which again were hereditary. His nephew had married Molly's uncle's urging to secure her family's headrights. Although it is, I mean, you can never know if someone like what's going on in their relationship, but they probably did fall in love. He was her chauffeur.
Oh.
Yeah, but Molly was diabetic, so it wouldn't have been like all that suspicious if she died earlier without a lot of explanation.
Right.
And even though Ernest had two children with her, Hale and his men or someone was poisoning her and she was getting sicker and sicker. And then when she moved away, she like immediately got better and was treated at a hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. So they focus in on Hale. So yeah, I guess again, he was powerful. He'd been able to bribe or intimidate anyone who had tried to come at him before until these BOI guys arrived in town. And then once they did, Ernest eventually confessed and turned against him. And that was sort of that.
Yeah. Well, they did. Yeah, I mean, you did describe him as weak-willed. So
yeah.
Yeah.
There is a scene in the movie where Hale like paddles Ernest just to show, I guess, his dominance over him. I mean, there's no evidence of that actually happening, but it's just indicative of what their relationship was.
Weird thing for your uncle to do to you.
It's a pretty weird thing, especially when you're a grown-up man.
Yeah. Like, if my uncle tried to paddle me, I would smack him so hard. That's probably about it. Or just, like, not let him. Or just feel like, don't.
Yeah. They have an odd relationship.
Yeah, clearly.
In any case, Ernest, Hale, and a couple of other men are arrested. Ernest, Burkhardt, and Hale are sentenced to life in prison, but both were later paroled. Hale never apologized or admitted guilt.
Wow.
And he died in 1962. So that's sort of the story. There's also, it's not the full story, and no one will probably ever know the full story, but the film is based on this book called Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI by David Gran. And he says that the true number of conspirators could be in the hundreds.
Wow.
So that's upsetting.
So did this directly lead into the founding of the FBI?
Well, it was one of their early cases of the BOI. And that helped, like,
just the title of the book made me be like, oh, so because of this, did they go, we need a federal bureau to investigate this? Or was it just like a catchy title?
I'm not sure. I don't know where the story is with the FBI, but probably it's like a successful case. The local police like couldn't.
That makes sense. Yeah. That they were like, oh, maybe we should have like a more prestigious elite group of people who like will go out and investigate these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is interesting. I know we have an article coming out on like the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which was sort of like this Wild West.
They're still around.
Law enforcement body. Yeah, they're still around.
They raided. It's so stupid. Wizards of the Coast, the company who makes Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons, is owned by Hasbro. These people ordered Magic the Gathering cards and they were like opening them. I think it was on a live stream or just maybe in a YouTube video, like doing like an unwrapping of these. And they basically got these cards early. They weren't supposed to get these cards. They were part of like the next set that was coming out. So Wizards of the Coast sent the Pinkerton Detective Agency to raid their house.
Wow.
And it was like traumatic. Like they were like...
Was it caught on the live stream?
I don't think so. I don't think it was like that instantaneous. That'd be cool. But like, these people were like traumatized by it because these guys basically showed up violently with guns because they're like an unregulated, like basically militant force.
Huh. So interesting.
Yeah. I've written like three different things recently where the Pinkertons come in. And it's always like they're brought in as strike breakers. The Homestead strike, the like big famous Homestead strike that happened in Pittsburgh, the Pinkertons were brought in and defeated. Good job, union workers, on that one. Yeah, they're not great. So
did you write the article that's coming out on the Pinkerton?
I did not.
Because there was something about like how the word like private eye comes from them. And I think it's because they're like, we never sleep. And they're like insignia was like an eye.
Yeah, they're sketchy as hell, man. I don't think they should be allowed to be around still.
It's funny that they're still around. I mean, I think back in like the Wild West days, it makes sense that there was someone like that. But
yeah, that's the shocking thing. That's why I started laughing because I was like, right, they used to be like this big thing and now they're busting people down for having trading cards a little early.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Come on, man. Really?
But yeah, I mean, I guess like the point is like in the 19th century and into the 20th, there was no like federal investigative. So that was like a new thing. In any case, back to Grant's book. The title of his book, Killers of the Flower Moon, comes from this Osage phrase, the time of the flower-killing moon, which refers to the month of May when blooming flowers on the hills die as taller plants crowd them out.
Wow.
So that kind of...
That's poetic.
That's a really good title. Yeah, it is. And I believe that's mentioned in the movie, actually, as well. Grant says that not only could there have been, like, many more conspirators, but also that many of the killings of the Osage tribal members remain unsolved because J. Edgar Hoover, we all know about him, was in a hurry just to close the case. So there was no resolution to those murders. Grand says, really, the case was closed prematurely. The Bureau didn't reveal a deeper, darker conspiracy. And as a result, many were able to escape justice.
Yeah, I believe that.
Plus Hoover charged them, the tribe, $20,000 for the investigation, which is just horrible.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
$20,000 in today's money or $20,000 then?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think then.
Wow.
I was talking to someone about this movie, and I think in the movie, which I have not seen, but I think in the movie it sort of implied that the president is like concerned about this and wants to help, and that's not, I don't think the president was that
probably
involved.
Not, no.
In the movie, Molly Burkhart goes to DC and she meets Calvin Coolidge, but that never happened. So
I'm just now learning that Brendan Fraser is in that movie.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, I didn't know that at all.
Who does he play?
W.S. Hamilton.
Sounds like maybe he's one of the white
guys. He's definitely
guys
white.
Who die. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there are some differences between the book and the movie. I mean, yeah, the first one is that Molly never met Calvin Coolidge. You know, Calvin Coolidge, I'm curious to see who that is in the movie. He doesn't come up a lot in American cinema.
Yeah.
Silent Cal.
Yeah, Coolidge is kind of like I don't know anything about him as a president. He's like so just... He was a president for sure.
He's a funny guy. He didn't like, I mean, his nickname was Silent Cal. He was known for not saying a lot. And he was at a dinner party once. And this woman said, Mr. President, I bet you, I don't know, some amount of money that I can get you to say three words during this dinner. And he turned to her and said, you lose.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. In the movie, he is played by Mark Landon Smith.
Not someone I've heard of.
He's really not in a lot. He's mostly known as a casting director.
Oh.
And a producer, so.
That's funny. Other things from the movie and the books, Anna Brown, who's one of the victims, was pregnant when she was killed. It's not mentioned in the movie, but Hale might have been the father, which meant that he killed his unborn child, which is pretty horrible.
Yeah, it's pretty dark.
In the book, Urquhart never admits to knowing that Molly was being poisoned. In fact, it's a bit unclear who was poisoning her, if he was doing that to his wife or what was going on there. Robert De Niro was much, much older than Hale was. I think Robert De Niro is like in his 80s or something now.
Yeah, he's old.
And then in addition to the paddling scene, there's also this jailhouse scene between Hale and Urquhart, which is not in the book, although I guess could have happened, but it's not described in the book.
The Box of Oddities is a Webby Award-winning podcast that explores a world that's strange, bizarre, and sometimes hilarious. Married couple Kat and Jethro Gilligan-Toth bring their irreverent brand of humor and unique chemistry to unusual topics that range from medical oddities to abandoned funeral homes to unexplained paranormal phenomena. With nearly 30 million downloads since its launch in 2018, The Box of Oddities has become a rapidly growing community of people who share an interest in the stranger side of life. In each episode, Kat and Jethro bring an independently picked true topic to surprise each other with. Often bizarre, shocking, or just plain weird, these topics are certainly always interesting. As late night host Jimmy Kimmel said, should you be the type who has interest in weird stuff, this is a fun thing to allow in your head. Go listen to The Box of Oddities wherever you get your podcasts.
Just to wrap this up here, the last little part of it is that the Osage tribe today is still living, you know, in the Osage Hills. The headrights are still in use, but they're not as lucrative as they were in the 1920s when there was like an oil boom.
Right.
The tribe has grown a lot, it's doubled in size, but the headrights are fixed at 2,229. And at this point, about 25% go to non-tribal members and organizations. So it's not quite the same, not quite as lucrative as it was in the 1920s. But, you know, like this moment in tribal history is very, it's like horrible. It's traumatic.
And yeah. I kind of said it with like a joking tone throughout this recording, like, oh, ha ha ha, white people, it's so bad. But like, yeah, they were.
Pretty bad. Pretty bad. It's horrible to steal the money in the first place and then to kill people to get to the money.
Right.
And then to charge the tribe to solve the case.
Yeah, even that is just like, it just really leaves a sour taste in your mouth. And that's what, like, I think to kind of harken back to when I was like, oh, this feels like it happened too recently in history.
Mm.
When I think of white settlers pushing native tribes out, I think like early settlement of America, like 1400s to late 1700s. And so for this to happen in the early 20th century really just shows like how perpetuated this like terrible treatment of indigenous tribes was.
Yeah. I mean, 20th century, you look at like the indigenous schools, that was a big 20th century thing.
Right. Right. We have a episode on that. Yeah,
we do. Yeah. And some stuff on the side about it as well. But yeah, it's a horrible history. And this is obviously an overlooked part of it until I think the film has brought a lot of attention to it. Yeah. Which is really fascinating. I mean, it's like horrible, but it's things like this and things like, I don't know. There's moments in American history that are so like papered over and you don't really learn about.
Yeah.
And it's usually things about Native history or Black history or women's history that just like is not taught as much. And then, but these things happen. And it's really fascinating when they're given more like weight.
Yeah. I think unless you actually like go on to study like American history specifically in college, or you have a job like we do where we learn about all these like interesting hidden things throughout history every day, you just don't know, because the schooling system just doesn't teach you a lot of this stuff.
Well, especially now, not to get like super political, but like especially now, it's like teaching anything that is at all critical
right.
of America and certain places can be,
it's a point of contention now.
Yeah. And that's not, I mean, how could you know the story unless you know these stories? These are American stories. So,
right. I mean, yeah, it all goes to shape the way this country is now.
Yeah.
And like, there were a lot of contributions and also a lot of bad things. Yet you got to take the good with the bad. I mean, it's no country's perfect. And that includes America. I think, you know, we have a pretty dark history. I think most countries have very dark history. Like, it's not exclusive to us. It's not exclusive to England. There are definitely countries who perpetuated this really bad treatment more than others. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's all relevant. It's all important to know and to understand and to, you know, you can look at it one of two ways. You can look at it pessimistically and be like, wow, we're terrible. Or you can be like, well, we've come a long way. This is a lot.
We're still terrible in some ways. And
yeah. I mean, this was 100 years ago, but like the world's changed a lot in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the difference between 1924 and 2024 is bigger than the difference between 1824 and 1924.
Hmm. Let's think about that. I think that's true. I think because 1924 to 2024, like we went to the moon.
Yeah.
You know, like
right.
airplanes became a thing.
A Second World War was fought.
Yeah.
Like the world became more connected. Technology.
Nuclear power.
Rapidly.
The internet.
Grew. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas like
1824 to 1924. I mean, like I said, like I mentioned the Transcontinental Railroad happened. Civil War happened. Like there's some pretty big stuff that went on.
Yeah.
That changed the world.
Definitely. Yeah. But I think it was more
gradual.
Yeah, yeah, more gradual, more like you could see the trajectory of how these things were going to go. It's like, okay, well, we have railroads. What if we made one go coast to coast?
Yeah.
And so it's like, but then all of a sudden people are like, you know, we went in 15 years from like the announcement of the iPhone to AI that can create videos that are indistinguishable from life.
Yeah.
Like that's a weird, major jump. So.
Yeah. I don't like that. I don't like AI.
Yeah.
Did you write the article that's coming out, I think, this weekend on the Wagner mutiny?
Nope.
Well, I think that's also by David Gran. Yes, it is by him.
Oh, I've been seeing a lot about this book. What's that book called? The Wager, right?
The Wager, yeah.
Oh, David Gran also wrote The Lost City of Z.
What's that?
A book that I've always looked at and then never read. It's about a 1925 explorer who ventured into the Amazon to find an ancient civilization, which was presumably called the Lost City of Z.
Oh, sounds interesting.
Percy Fawcett, that was the guy's name.
Oh, that sounds kind of familiar. So our next episode is on Mary Magdalene. And then after that, it's History Happy Hour.
Yeah. And then Teddy Roosevelt?
And then it's Teddy Roosevelt. Boy. Yeah. Then it's Teddy Roosevelt.
You're really leading the push here coming up.
Yeah. So a lot of my outlines.
Yeah.
I have to say, I wrote the Teddy Roosevelt one yesterday and I was like, just like poured out. I was like so excited to write about it. So,
I'm excited to talk about him. Yeah.
Yeah. Such a cool story.
Yeah. My favorite president.
He's a good one. He's a good president to be your favorite president. So stick around and stay tuned. All good stuff coming up in the weeks to come.
If you want to learn more about the Osage murders, about any of the other things we talked about here, about the Pinkerton Detective Agency, or about the Wager Mutiny, another story by David Zann, head on over to allthat'sinteresting.com, where we are updating the site constantly, every single day, with interesting new stories, as the name would suggest. You can also join our newsletter there at allthat'sinteresting.com/signup, or if you want to support the site, you can become a member at allthat'sinteresting.com/membership.
Yes. And you can also write or call in. We love to hear from listeners your thoughts about the show. If you notice something you want to, I don't know, a fact that you know something about.
What's your least favorite thing white people have done?
Yeah. I'm curious to know. Someone did just email in. It was a Jack the Ripper thing. So I'm not sure if we're going to save that for History Happy Hour.
We can bring it up now.
Oh, someone, last time we were talking about how cool it would be if Jack the Ripper was in a time travel TV show.
Right, right.
And someone emailed in and was like, actually, there was a TV series. It's called Goodnight Sweetheart. And it's a British TV show. The main character's name is Gary, and he travels back and forth. And he meets Jack the Ripper one of these days. Apparently, it was a comedy. Jack the Ripper is run over by a trash truck. Yeah. This is an email from a listener named Helen. We all got a big kick out of it. So that was a lot of fun to
It sounds very read about. Like up my alley, because that's a mid-90s British sitcom. And love 90s British things.
Yeah. I mean, we love getting emails like that or voicemails. And you can leave either. If you want to leave a voicemail, the number is 929-526-3029. Or you can email us at podcast@allthat'sinteresting.com. We do read all those and they are exciting to receive. And otherwise, we can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Hopefully a nice review.
Yeah. Sorry, I got distracted. This show apparently ran from 1993 to 1999, but then looks like there was a brief revival in 2016.
Huh.
And that just was surprising to me.
I had not heard of it, but if it's British, then it sounds like we just never would have.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't quite make the
leap across the Atlantic.
No. Until now. Thanks, Helen.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. I guess the last thing is we're on social, but I can never remember our social handles, so that's all you.
Yeah, History Uncovered Podcast over on Instagram and Real History Uncovered on TikTok for that delicious bite-sized content.
Yeah.
You can share it with your friends. You can share it with your enemies. You can share it with virtually anybody who doesn't have you blocked.
There you go.
And even then, you could probably find a way.
It's always a way. Where there's a will, there's a way.
They say love finds a way, but so does hate.
I mean, as this episode might show.
I was going to say, I was talking more like interpersonal hate, not hate as a concept. But
yeah. So we'll be back with Mary Magdalene next next week.
Which Mary is that? Mary Magdalene? Is she royal of some kind?
She's the one.
Oh, is she Jesus's mom?
Not his mom.
Oh, okay.
But his female follower, who some believe was his wife.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting to talk about. You can tell my Bible school didn't stick.
You never saw like Jesus Christ Superstar?
Surprisingly, no.
You should watch the 1970s film. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it. I've always been curious. Something I always wanted to see live.
Oh, no. I mean, maybe. I think the film was just so good.
Okay. I'll add it to the list.
And then we could talk about that during the podcast taping.
Fair enough. I will watch it then before then. Is Pittsburgh 22? Are they performing it somewhere around here? Oh, my God, they are.
I mean, there's probably. I think it's still around.
Yeah, I could go see it at the end of April, live in Pittsburgh.
Hmm.
Is it a comedy?
No.
Really?
It's a rock opera.
Oh.
Yeah.
I just always assumed it was a comedy because of the name Superstar.
It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. I mean, it's like, what if Jesus was like our first superstar in human history?
Right, but not a comedy.
It's not a comedy.
That's
I mean,
weird.
It's the story of Jesus's crucifixion, basically.
Well, Life of Brian was that also, and that was fun.
Well, this isn't funny.
Huh. That's really surprising.
But it is cool.
To me.
I mean, I think when Andrew Lloyd Webber was like 24 when he wrote it, something like that.
Wow.
I know.
Wow. The same guy who did Cats.
Same guy who did Cats.
And School of Rock.
He did School of Rock?
Like a musical version.
Oh, that's fun. Anyway, we'll dig into that next week.
Bye.
Bye. Till next time.
Love history but hate when it's stuffy and boring? Well, look no further and join me, Katie Charlwood, your friend, the neighborhood social scientist and reader of books, as I delve into unsolved historical mysteries, murders by gaslight, and of course, women who have been misrepresented through all time. On Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.